All right, good morning. I'm going to go ahead and get started. We are right on, maybe even a few seconds before 9 o'clock. We got everything set up and don't want to, you know, wait around too long and have everything turn off and switch off. So you guys should have in front of you a set of notes for lesson 88. The Two Streams of Bibles Model of Transmission, Its Origins and Accuracy, Part 2. So this is Part 2. Today we're going to be looking specifically at the Peshitta translation, and I'll explain a bit more about that here as we get rolling. Okay. First, if I could direct your attention also to the fact that you have a separate appendix again. It's shorter this time. It only includes four things. And I'll be kind of saying why that's the case here in a few minutes. So you do have the two items. You have the main set of notes, and then you also have the appendix that goes with it. So I want to get started right away and be looking at the introduction and review. I've given a little bit longer of an introduction review this time because last Sunday was the first time ever that I had taught some things. So I wanted to just kind of go back through some of the high points of that in the introduction to this morning. So last week in lesson 87, we began looking at the origins and accuracy of the two streams of Bibles paradigm for how preservation / transmission was accomplished. In doing so, we covered the following points. Number one, we looked at the two streams view of transmission. I summarized that for you. We looked at like 12 different examples of drawings or charts that have been put together over time on that, and we did that last time. Second, we looked at the origins of the two streams of Bibles paradigm, and then third, we looked at my first beginning to question that, or the origin of me beginning to question the reliability, whether or not that was true or not. So we looked at that. So if we look at the next point. Given that lesson 87 was the first time I ever taught this information, and I did not finish explaining point three. So technically today's lesson is still point three. It's still under the category of my first questioning of it, okay? And why and how I started to do that, okay? So since, given that lesson 87 was the first time I'd ever taught this information, I did not finish explaining point three, I'd like to review some of the key points, in the introduction to this lesson, okay? So first thing I did is I showed you. We're just going to use this one to keep it simple, okay? On the first point, the two streams of Bible's view of transmission. On this point, I highlighted my historic, uncritical embrace of the two streams of Bible's paradigm of transmission. So I talked to you about how I had read all this literature, and I had just accepted it, okay? I did not think that they would be misrepresenting things, that they would be dealing in a way that was contrary to the facts and so forth. And so I had just embraced this from the time of my late teens and early 20s when I first started getting involved in Bible study and Bible teaching and so forth. I thought that this was true, okay? In addition, we looked at multiple examples of charts and diagrams created by various individuals and ministries depicting the two streams of Bible's model. Lastly, we noted how all the various depictions of the two streams paradigm agree on the following points, okay? So I have this one up here again, just very quickly. You have the corrupt stream here, the Alexandrian stream on the bottom in the gray. Then on the top, you have the pure Antiochian stream. And we looked at a few different ways that people have drawn this and conceptualized that over time. Whatever drawing they use, whatever chart they use, whatever conception they use, they all agree on the following points of summary from the notes, okay? So these would be the open bullets on page one. Number one, the two streams or lines, they all assert that there are two streams or lines of Bibles. Some will say two trees, as we'll see in a minute, okay? One of them emanating from Antioch, the other from Alexandria, Egypt. So that's point one that all these charts, diagrams, depictions agree on. Point number two. One stream is pure, the Antiochian, and the other stream is corrupt, the Alexandrian. So that's the second point they all agree on. Number three. The manuscripts of the Byzantine text type are always placed in the pure stream, whereas the principal witnesses, to the so-called Alexandrian texts, such as Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Vaticanus, and Codex Alexandrinus, are always placed in the corrupt line. Okay? So if you look at this, this is what you'll see. Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus, down here on the corrupt line. And up here at the top, you would have the multiplicity of copies of the Byzantine text type in the pure stream. Okay? Number four. The Italia, or Old Latin, Peshitta, and Gothic translations, among others, are always placed in the pure stream, thereby giving the impression that these early translations are in complete agreement with the Textus Receptus, the text of the Reformation, and the King James Bible, because they are in the same stream. So again, here you see the Old Latin, the Old Syriac, or the Peshitta, the Gothic, all of them are in this stream that ultimately culminates with the King James Bible. Okay? So you have the opposing streams. So again, the points we're going through right now are the summary takeaways from all of these various depictions, no matter how they are drawn or put together. Okay? Number five. In contrast, Jerome's Latin Vulgate is always placed in the corrupt stream emanating from Alexandria, Egypt, and culminating in the various editions of the critical text and modern versions. So if you look down here in the gray, you'll see Jerome's Latin Vulgate in the corrupt stream on this particular diagram. Okay? Sixth summary point, top of page two. Therefore, these charts depict the Old Latin, or Italia, and Gothic translations as, quote, good Bibles, and the Vulgate as, quote, bad. Okay? More specifically, the Old Latin and Vulgate are pitted against each other as rivals in opposing streams. Okay? Does everybody see that? So again, that's this point here. Here's the Vulgate down here in the corrupt stream, and here's the Old Latin in the, or the Italia, same thing, okay, in the preserved stream or the pure stream. Lastly, these charts leave their readers with the impression that there is an unbroken line of systematic and sequential corruption stretching back to the earliest centuries of church history in the following reverse order. Okay, so we're going to start with the most recent. So we're starting at the level of where we live today, modern versions. So the New American Standard, the NIV, the ESV, the New King James, translations of the 20th and 21st centuries. Working back, those came from the various editions of the United Bible Society Greek text or the Nestle-Aland Greek text. Then the first revision was the revised version of 1881, which was a translation of the Westcott and Hort Greek New Testament, which also came out in 1881. Then working back further, you would have the Douay Catholic New Testament or the Douay Rheims translation. Then from there, working back, you'd have Codex Alexandrinus from the 5th century. Then you would have Jerome's Latin Vulgate from 382. Then you'd have Codex Sinaiticus and Codex Vaticanus, somewhere between 330 and 350, allegedly or supposedly. And then you'd have Origen, then the Papyri, then Alexandria, Egypt. Okay? So that's working backward from where we are today to the earliest time. So that would be reading this chart, starting on this side on the end in the pink stuff with the modern version, and working back this way towards the point of origin in Alexandria, Egypt. Okay? All of them give you that impression. Again, let me say that again, that there is an unbroken or systematic and sequential line of corruption that stretches all the way back to Alexandria, Egypt, and manifests itself in modern times in the Nestle-Aland and United Bible Society's text in Greek, as well as modern versions in English. Okay? So that's a summary of the two streams of Bible's idea. Next, we look at the historical origins of the two streams of Bible's paradigm. Regarding the historical origins of the two streams of Bible's transmissional model, we noted that it was first articulated by Benjamin G. Wilkinson in his 1930 book, Our Authorized Bible Vindicated. Again, that's this book right here. This is a reprinting of it. It's not an original from 1930, but I have compared it against ones online, and all the wording is the same. Okay. So he's the first one to talk about this idea of the two streams. Furthermore, we observed how once this notion was deposited into the thought stream by Wilkinson, it was picked up on by later defenders of the traditional text and the Authorized Version and advanced in an uncritical manner. So I showed you last Sunday how Wilkinson says it first in 1930. Then in 1955, 15 years later, J.J. Ray writes this book, God Only Wrote One Bible, where he takes the idea that was first articulated by Wilkinson and he repeats it in his book from 1955. Then you go forward another 9 years. From 1964, Peter Ruckman wrote The Bible Babel, which is also has the same idea in it. And then you go forward from there to 1970, and David Otis Fuller edits Which Bible? Okay, in Which Bible? Which Bible contains a reprint in 1970 of Wilkinson's book from 1930? Okay, so if you look in Which Bible, you will find one of the entries is Our Authorized Bible Vindicated by Benjamin Wilkinson is now it's edited, and there's some things we have to talk about this about it later on that are some funny business or shenanigans that Fuller is engaging in when he does this. But the point is that he says it first, then Ray, then Ruckman, and then David Otis Fuller talks about it in Which Bible. And then it becomes sort of a fixture of the pro-King James movement in the United States. Okay? So if you look at your notes, excuse me, I'm at the bottom of page 2. Further investigation this week revealed an even stronger tie between the work of Ray and Ruckman. It appears that Ruckman got his two trees illustration directly from J.J. Ray. So this would be your appendix. So if you guys want to grab that appendix, I have here some slides. Okay? So on the left, this is J.J. Ray's tree from his 1955 book, God Only Wrote One Bible. And this would be his corrupt tree. Notice what he has on this tree, what the fruit of the tree are at the top, and then compare it to what Ruckman did on the next page. Okay? So you can see that Ruckman's tree is almost identical to the one that Ray put out 14 years earlier, okay? So the fruit is the same. The majority of the branches are relatively the same. Ruckman has a few things that he adds to his, but by and large, it's nearly exactly the same as the one that J.J. Ray put out some 14 years earlier in 1944, okay? So if you go to then page 12 in your appendix, here is the good stream, or the good tree, and you'll notice here that this is J.J. Ray's on this side from 1955, and notice that he's got the Peshitta, the Italia, the Wycliffe Bible, Erasmus, and Tyndale, and so forth, but notice specifically that he's got the Peshitta from 150, and he's got the Italia Bible from 157, on that tree, okay? If you go to the next one, you'll see exactly the same thing, just about nearly identical again from Ruckman 14 years later, okay? So I just want you to see that there's a high degree here of borrowing from the previous what? Author. If you want to say it uncharitably, you might say parroting what the previous guy said, okay? So you just need to see that once the idea is deposited, it gets picked up on and advanced by subsequent generations of authors, okay? So look at the bottom of page 2. Through the twin influences of Ruckman and Fuller. So Ruckman and Fuller are the real influential ones here, okay? Through the twin influences of Ruckman and Fuller, the two streams of Bible's paradigm of transmission cemented itself into the argumentation of the King James only movement. Later, pro-King James authors repeated this talking point in some manner to varying degrees. And then last week I gave you a whole list of people who have done that, okay? And even that list was not exhaustive because I found more stuff this week that I could have added to the list from last week, okay? So that brings us to a summary of our third point from last week, my first questioning of the two streams of Bible's paradigm at the top of page 3. So, having read much of the literature from the King James Holy Movement, I had taken for granted the truthfulness of the two streams of Bible's paradigm. Since the notion is so prevalent in the literature of the movement, I assumed that it had been factually vetted for accuracy, and therefore I accepted it as true. Okay? So my reasoning was, there's no way that they would be advancing a narrative here that has never been what? Never been vetted, never been checked, never been studied, right? And I just accepted it. I saw it in book after book after book, and so I just accepted it as being what? Being true. Okay? Look at the next point. Knowing that I had never studied the truthfulness of the model for myself, I started researching to see what I could find on the Peshitta and Gothic translations in the summer of 2018. Okay? Now, why did I do the Peshitta and the Gothic first? Because, now the Gothic's not on these ones, it's on some of the other ones we looked at, like the first one, but I knew that the Peshitta is always on these charts, either on the good tree or in the pure what? The pure stream or the pure line, right? Same with the Gothic when authors include it, okay? Therefore, it was not until recently, when preparing to teach the current segment of this class, September 2018 through May 2019, that I encountered information while researching the Gothic Bible that caused me to question the paradigm's veracity for the first time. Okay? In Lesson 87, last Sunday, I showed you how the Gothic Bible is depicted on many of the two streams of Bible's charts. Many of these charts place the Gothic in the pure stream along with the manuscripts of the Byzantine Majority, the Textus Receptus, and the King James Bible. Then we looked at specific passages in the Gothic that contain readings that King James advocates would find corrupt. Lastly, we compared our observations regarding readings from the Gothic Bible with the characterization of this translation in the writings of Gail Ripplinger. Okay? Now, I just want to share an additional thing. So I brought with me also another book that I have, Final Authority, A Christian's Guide to the King James Bible by William P. Grady. And on page 34, he says some things about the Gothic translation that I did not say last week. He says, so there's two paragraphs here. The first one says, the first translation into a purely European tongue is known as the Gothic version. This work was prepared in 330 A.D. by the soul-winning missionary Ulfius, whose name means little wolf. Once again, the stretch of this version is found in its age, and the strength, excuse me, of this version is found in its age and agreement with the Textus Receptus. So, does that give you the impression that there's total agreement between the Gothic Bible and the Textus Receptus, okay? Edward F. Hills cites Frederick G. Kenyon's 1912 edition of the New Testament Criticism that, quote, the type of text represented is for the most part that which is found in the majority of Greek manuscripts. So Kenyon is not saying in 1912 that the Gothic Bible is wholly representative of the traditional text, is he? He's saying it is for the most part, right? So is he saying that there are maybe some instances where it's not? Okay? Second paragraph. Thus Ulfius, now listen to what they do with this. Thus Ulfius had access to King James Version readings a full two decades before Sinaiticus and Vaticanus were copied. An excellent example of his superior manuscripts is reflected by the Gothic inclusion of the traditional ending to the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6:13. The familiar words, "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever, amen," are conspicuously absent from both of the two ancient, the two most ancient authorities. Okay? There are also 8 surviving manuscripts of the Gothic version. A sample of the Lord's Prayer in its barbaric northern dialect would resemble the following, then he gives it to you in Gothic, which I'm not going to try to read. Okay? But do you see what he does? He takes one example where it is in line with the traditional text in the King James Version, Matthew 16:13, and then extrapolates and says, see, the whole thing won. The whole thing is pure. Okay? Does everybody see that? So, I've gone almost 20 minutes on the introduction. That's not good. Our major takeaway, then, from last Sunday, our major takeaway was that in its extant form, or its existing form, the Gothic Bible contains readings that advocates of the two streams of transmission paradigm would never tolerate from modern versions. Yet, they list the Gothic in the pure stream of transmission on their charts. They don't talk about Mark chapter 1. They don't talk about the woman taken in adultery. They don't talk about Colossians chapter 1, verse 14, or 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 16, or any of the other ones that we looked at last Sunday that have readings in them that they would never approve of in a modern version, yet none of that is discussed. Yet another example furnished this morning by Grady in his book. Okay? Is everybody with that? Okay? So let's continue my point then about my first questioning of the model. Since the Peshitta and Gothic translations are always listed in the good or pure stream of Bibles, I decided to look at the Peshitta next. Okay? So that's autobiographical there. I first looked at the Gothic. Thoroughly irritated, I decided to look at the Peshitta next. Okay? So, look at the next point. The Peshitta, along with the Gothic, is always listed in the pure stream of transmission on two streams of Bibles, charts, and diagrams. As far as I can tell, this was done for the first time when J.J. Ray placed the Peshitta on his Good Tree of Bibles in his 1955 book, God Wrote Only One Bible. So that's this chart right here with the Peshitta as the first branch on this tree. Okay? I cannot find anybody doing that before 1955 when Ray wrote that book. J.J. Ray wrote that book. Okay? Benjamin Wilkinson had not included the Peshitta on his two parallel streams of Bibles table in 1930. So, let me just make this clear. So did he talk about the Peshitta in 1930? No. Does he include the Peshitta in 1955? Yes. Okay? So, not only do we see the advancement of the idea forward, but we see successive generations adding more and more layers, what? To it as the thing gets passed on. Is everybody following that? Okay? Regarding the Peshitta, Ray stated the following, quote, "A number of textual authorities state that the Bible of the Syrian church, the Peshitta, was translated from the Greek Vulgate," that's another word for the received text, okay, "in Syria about 150 A.D. This view is favored by G.H.G. William, learned Syrian scholar and editor. His views are supported by Bergen and Miller and others. This Peshitta version is admired by Syriac scholars as a careful, faithful, simple, direct, literal version, clear and forceful in style. These characteristics have given it the title Queen of the Versions." Antioch, do you guys have a typo there in yours?
Yeah.
Antioch was the capital of Syria, where the early believers were first called Christians, Acts 11:26. In a few years, the Syrian believers could be numbered by the thousands. Their Bible, the Peshitta, even today, generally follows the received text. This is another proof that the foundation of the King James Bible is older and more reliable than the Vatican manuscript, which was elevated to the chair of authority by Westcott and Hort. A couple things I want you to see here. Number one, why do they think they have to make this argument about the Peshitta and other translations? Because they are trying to establish a witness that is older than the two so-called oldest and best manuscripts, right? So in other words, if Aleph and B are from, well, I'm just going to say 350, but the Peshitta is from 150, aha! Okay? This is what this is saying. Therefore, this reading is 200 years older than what? Than that reading. So they're trying to antedate the two so-called oldest and best. Okay? That's partially, or a big portion of what is motivating the emphasis on these early translations. and ignoring the places where the early translations actually agree with what? Now, don't look at me like you're shocked, right? Did I show you last Sunday with the Gothic that dates from anywhere between 330 and 360 that it has Western readings in it that agree with the two so-called oldest and best? Okay? The reason why they're putting an emphasis on the Peshitta is to antedate Aleph and V by 2 centuries. I understand the motivation. I get what they're trying to do intellectually. The issue is, are they being honest with the evidence? Does everybody follow what I'm saying? Lolly, okay, all right. You look confused. Okay. I didn't mean to single you out or anything. So, as noted above, so I'm on page 4, as noted above in 1964, Dr. Peter S. Ruckman followed Ray in placing the Peshitta on his Good Tree of Bibles in his book, The Bible Babble. Okay? The following from the pen of Dr. David H. Sorensen in Touch Not the Unclean Thing, The Text Issue and Separation, is emblematic of what is commonly said about the Peshitta in pro-King James literature. He says, quote, another ancient translation of the New Testament is the Syrian Peshitta version. It should be recalled that it was in Antioch of Syria that the disciples were first called Christians. Moreover, the church at Antioch was the sending church as well as the home church of the Apostle Paul. Accordingly, a translation of the New Testament into Syrian was made in AD 150. This translation was called the Peshitta version. Even Hort acknowledges that this translation paralleled the received text. Is he claiming does that mean it's an identical match? No, it just means that there's some elements of confluence and agreement between them. It doesn't mean that they're what? Totally the same. All right? Of interest is the word Peshitta is a Syrian word which means common. It thus was analogous to the later Latin term Vulgate, which essentially means the same thing. It would also approximate to the later sense the term received text, or in this case, version of the Bible for a given language. There's little question, even by proponents of the critical text, that the Peshitta version was translated from a Greek text rooted in the received text. The greater point, however, is that one of the earliest churches of the Christian era used a translation of the New Testament based upon the received text. Okay? This is a clear indication that the received text was the true text of the New Testament with roots running back to the Autographia. Now, do I think the received text is the true text? Yes. But is he giving you all the information? Or is he selectively showing you what he wants you to see? Okay? Now look at the next point. This is a very important point. Please note that neither Ray nor Sorensen cite any textual examples as evidence to substantiate their claims regarding the Peshitta. Okay? Rather, in the case of Ray, he appeals to the authority of other writers such as G. William, Bergen, Miller, Robinson, or Vetter to substantiate his claims. The same could be said for a host of other pro-King James works. So in other words, are they going back and showing you examples of readings from the Peshitta that would prove their point? Or are they just stacking up circumstantial evidence from the pen of other writers and passing that off as evidence for what they're saying? Is everybody following that? Okay. So, Lolly, would you mind getting the door, please?
I sure can.
Thank you. Using the Peshitta New Testament website, I was able to check readings of English translations of the Peshitta for myself against the King James. The following points are a summary of what I found. First, the oldest extant witness to the Peshitta dates from the 5th century. Okay? So we don't have anything older that we know of on the Peshitta that's older than sometime during the 400s AD. And they say, again, that it was done in what year?
150.
Okay? So that's the first thing you need to know. Second, it is important to know that there have been three major translations of the Peshitta into English in the last 150 years. In 1849, John Wesley Etheridge did a translation. In 1851, James Murdoch did a translation. In 1933, George Lamsa did a translation. And then more recently, in 2006, Janet Mingeria, an associate to Lamsa, published an Aramaic Peshitta New Testament vertical interlinear in three volumes. Okay? So in the last 150 years, there have been three translations of the Peshitta into English. Now, look at the next point. An examination of the readings found in these translations reveals that the extant witnesses to the Peshitta New Testament are anything but the showpieces of textual purity assumed by the two streams of Bible's paradigm. Okay? Now remember, so next point, extant, or next sentence, extant copies and printed editions of the Peshitta in Syriac are widely varied in terms of their readings, okay, as the following examples will demonstrate. We will begin by comparing the same passages that we considered in Lesson 87 when looking at the extant Gothic Bible in the same order. So we're going to look at the same sampling of passages that we did last week for the Gothic. We're going to look at the same passages this week in the Peshitta so that we can compare apples with apples during this. Okay? I could have done any number of examples here, but I'm trying to keep it simple, number one, and number two, consistent to what we were able to do last time. Is everybody with me so far? So let's look at a few of these. Mark chapter 1, verse 2. Every single one of them, Etheridge, 1849, Murdoch, 1851, and Lamsa, 1933, all of them read as it is written in Isaiah the prophet. The King James reads as it is written in what? The prophets. And we talked about that last Sunday, about why prophets is the correct reading, because Mark is citing two different prophets. He's citing Isaiah and he's citing Malachi. Okay? So do the Gothic and the Peshitta agree together that the reading should be Isaiah the prophet? If you recall from last Sunday. Okay, so look at the point underneath. Just as we observed last week with the Gothic, the Peshitta contains a critical text reading in Mark 1-2, a popular verse for easily discerning the textual basis of a given translation. Yet we are assured by Ray and Sorensen, as well as other King James-only authors, that the Peshitta was translated from an early form of the received text. Yet it has a reading that they would not tolerate in a modern version. Does everybody see that? Okay. So the next example is Colossians 1:14. The King James Bible reads, "In whom we have redemption." What's the critical phrase? Through his blood, even the forgiveness of sins. If you look at Etheridge, Murdoch, and Lamsa, all three of them leave out what phrase? Through his blood. So again, a critical text reading in what is supposed to be a holy, pure what?
Line.
Okay, a reading that they would never tolerate from a modern version or the critical text is once again found in the Peshitta, in the extant copies of the Peshitta. Okay, so look at the point underneath that. All three translations of the Peshitta leave out the blood of Christ in Colossians 1:14. Why would this be? Now this is important, okay? Because the Syriac manuscripts and or printed editions they are translating into English do not contain the phrase through his blood. You can't translate a phrase into English that's not in the source that you're trying to translate. So the reason it's not in the English translation of the Peshitta is because it's not in the Syriac manuscripts that they're translating. You guys following that? Okay? Like we saw with the Gothic in Lesson 87, the Peshitta contains a critical text reading in Colossians 1:14, yet we are assured many times over in pro-King James literature of its textual purity. Yeah. Let's look at the next example. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 16. So this one ended up on two separate pages. Look, the King James says, "And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness, God was manifest in the flesh." Okay? Look at the various witnesses to the Peshitta. Notice that it does not say God was manifest in the flesh. It says which was revealed in what? The flesh. So there is a removal of a direct reference to who? To God. So a verse that would speak to the deity of Christ, okay, is altered in the extant witnesses of the Peshitta. So go to page 6 and look at my point underneath that chart. So if you are watching this at home or listening after the fact, you're going to want to access the notes from the church website where you can look at these readings. King James advocates excoriate the critical text and modern versions for attacking the deity of Christ in this verse for not reading God was manifest in the flesh. Yet many of the same people place the Peshitta in the line of pure Bibles along with the King James Version on their two streams of Bibles charts, despite it containing a reading in 1 Timothy 3:16 that they would not approve of in modern versions. Once again, the reason the Peshitta reads as it does in English is because of how the text reads in the extant Syriac manuscripts. Okay? So that's three examples, and so far we're 0 for 3 in terms of readings that would agree with the so-called pure stream of Bibles. You guys following this? Okay, Luke 2:33. In this case, we have the correct reading, in my opinion. All three say, but Joseph and his mother, not his father and his what? Mother. Okay, so in Luke 2:33, the Peshitta, like the Gothic, maintains the doctrine of the virgin birth of Christ by reading Joseph, not father, as the critical text and modern versions do in this verse. So on that verse, is the Peshitta good?
Yeah.
The first three, not so good. This verse, what?
Good.
Good. Okay? Now we get even more interesting. The woman taken in adultery is the next example. John 7:53 through 8:11. Etheridge, from 1849, does not contain the narrative of the woman taken in adultery. It is missing. Yet, Murdoch from 1851 and Lamsa from 1933 both contain the passage. You with that? Okay? Obviously, the King James Bible contains the passage. So look at the notations underneath this example. In the case of the woman taken in adultery, John 7:53 through 8:11, the extant evidence from the Peshitta is mixed. Etheridge was clearly translating from a manuscript copy or copies that did not contain the narrative, whereas Murdoch and Lamsa include the passage. Murdoch's translation includes the following footnote on John 7:53. So he's got a notation at the bottom, at the margin at the bottom. He says, quote, "This 53rd verse is wanting in many early editions of the Syriac New Testament. So also the whole story of the adulteress in the following chapter," and we need to fix the Roman numeral to 8, not 5, 8 through 11. So what did Murdoch just tell you? He just told you that the evidence in the source language is what? Mixed. Some have the passage, some what? Some don't have the passage. So once again, bottom of 6, page 6, once again, the extant evidence speaks to the mixed nature of the Peshitta's text. Yet none of these factors are ever discussed in King James-only literature. So if you pick these books up and you read them, do they talk about what I'm going over with you right now? No. You are left with a particular impression. Mark 16:9 through 20. So that would be the extended ending on Mark that is missing from Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus. Notice that Etheridge, Murdoch, Lomsa, all contain the passage. Okay? So again, the Peshitta is mixed. Is your hand up?
No.
Okay. I thought you were raising your hand. The evidence from the Peshitta is mixed. Does it contain some pure readings? Maybe a lot of it's pure. Does it contain some, though, that advocates who place it on these types of diagrams would never approve of in a modern version?
Mm-hmm.
And yet they don't discuss any of what we're talking about right now. So go to top page 7. So again, the extant textual witnesses to the Peshitta agree with the readings found in the received text and the King James Version in this passage. That would be Mark 16, 9 through 20. The long ending of Mark is part of the biblical text of the Peshitta. Acts 8, 37. Etheridge omits it altogether. Murdoch includes it in brackets. Lomsa includes it in the text without any citations or brackets that I can discern. Okay? So we've got one omitting Acts 8:37 altogether. We've got a second putting it in but offsetting it with brackets with a footnote, which we'll read in a minute. And then we have a third that just includes it in the text as though it were just supposed to be part of the text. Okay? So that, again, the three witnesses, the three translations of the Peshitta are varied. So, in Acts 8:37, Etheridge omitted the verse altogether, while Murdoch included the verse with brackets around it, thereby indicating the questionable nature of the reading. Okay? Moreover, Murdoch included the following footnote explaining his decision to place brackets around the verse. So this is his reason for why he's putting brackets around it. He says, quote, "This 37th verse is not in any of the earlier editions, and is excluded from the text of the London editions of 1816 and 1826. Now, what he's talking about, the London editions, would be two printed editions of the Peshitta. Not handwritten copies of manuscripts, but printed editions that were done in London in two separate years. Okay? So in other words, there are some copies of the Peshitta that don't have that verse in it, and there are other copies that do. Again, in the case of Acts 8:37, we see discrepancies between the extant manuscripts of the Peshitta. Therefore, the textual situation with the Peshitta is not as clear-cut as the two streams of Bibles would have us believe. Okay, and then let's look at the third example, and then we'll see if anybody has any questions. And that's 1 John 5:7. King James says, okay, "For there are three that bear record in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one." So, if you look at the examples that are given there, okay, Lomsa from 1933, he has the whole verse. Murdoch includes the verse with brackets and a footnote that we'll see in a second. And then Etheridge has something sort of wholly its own thing, okay? So Lomsa's reading of 1 John 5:7 agrees completely with the King James Bible. Meanwhile, Murdoch included the verse with brackets as Etheridge's translation reads something else entirely. As in the previous examples, Murdoch provides a footnote explaining why he put brackets around verse 7. The footnote reads, quote, "This verse is wanting in most manuscripts and is omitted in the edition of London from 1826. So that means that there is a printed edition of the Peshitta that was printed in London in 1826 that did not include 1 John 5 7, okay? So again, we can see that the extant manuscripts of the Peshitta disagree with each other in terms of their readings in some key verses with important textual variants. Okay? Does anybody have any questions about any of that? Craig?
So going up to what you drew on the board there, the thing that occurs to me is, you know, that that's just playing right into our opponent's terms, as we've talked about before, that, you know, the old is the best. But to take some of the
I agree. I think a lot of this stuff that you see here is an attempt to meet critical text modern version advocates on their own grounds. Okay? Now, you might argue that to some extent, if I'm looking at the Peshitta, sometimes the Peshitta is going to support the traditional text, and sometimes it's what? It's not. Okay? But to say, or to make people think, that they're wholly the same when they're not, to me, is not only dishonest, it's misleading. It's not being honest with what's really going on. Okay? Now, you know, we could debate and discuss why you would do that, what the motivation would be behind that, but ultimately it's got to be related to trying to, what they're trying to do is get something older than this on record that agrees with the King James and the Textus Receptus. That I understand what they're trying to do, but I think that they take that, and that might be a legitimate thing to do on a case-by-case what? Basis, on a reading-by-reading basis. And again, I'm going to point out, none of these books give you any textual examples. None of them do. They just are like, well, the Peshitta this or the Peshitta that because Dr. So-and-so said so. So it's really a lot of, you know, appeal to authority of other writers than it is giving anyone any concrete evidence. Okay? Yeah.
So looking at this, as we discussed about being able to look back and see that, you know, God has preserved his word, but be able to also see the attacks against the word of God from the enemy. What does Scripture say about how the devil operates? That the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field. I mean, this is something that is, you know, you have to look at this for yourself in order to see the subtleties that have happened against the attack.
Well, I agree with that, but I want to say also something else that I should have said at the beginning, but I forgot to. We're in the, like, I'm going somewhere with this, but I can't just go there without telling you why I started to question it. Okay? Where I'm going ultimately is an explanation of why I think the transmission turnpike is a better illustration of the facts that we actually have and can know and can prove than these two streams of Bibles paradigms that we're talking about now. But I have to show you why what I found looking at that so that you can understand why I'm saying a different understanding is in order. Does that make sense? Okay? If I just jump straight to the different understanding and I don't explain why I felt a new understanding was in order, then maybe that's not necessarily a good way of going about it, right? This way takes longer, but you've got to see what the issues are so that you can understand why we're doing the thing later on. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. Now, I want to make sure we have time to get to the conclusion and then if there's time for some questions. So I'm on the bottom of page 7. Charts and literature authored by King James advocates depicting two streams, or that should say two streams of Bibles, always place the Peshitta in the pure stream. Few, if any, textual examples are ever cited to justify such a placement. Instead, readers of these works find appeals to the authority of other authors to substantiate the placement of the Peshitta in the pure stream of transmission, as in the case of J.J. Ray. And the citation of that is on page 3. Okay? Ray is correct that Bergen, now we should probably just go look at that quick. Go, just flip back to page 3, just quick. I want you to see what I'm talking about. Okay? So flip back to page 3. This is the citation from J.J. Ray. And look at the very bottom of the page, the open bullet, at the bottom of page 3, first paragraph, okay? It says, a number of textual authorities. This is a total appeal to authority. What J.J. Ray is doing is appealing to the authority of other men and what they said about the Peshitta. He's not giving you any textual discussion to justify why he thinks the Peshitta should be on that tree. Okay? A number of textual authorities state that the Bible of the Syrian church, the Peshitta, was translated from the Greek Vulgate into Syrian, about 150 AD. This view is favored by G.H.G. William, learned Syrian scholar and editor. His view is supported by Bergen and Miller and others. And that's what he says. So go back to page 8. Okay? So, second sentence, top of page 8. Ray is correct that Bergen used the Peshitta to justify the antiquity of individual traditional readings against the critical text of Westcott and Hort and its principal uncial witnesses, Aleph and B. Okay? So, Bergen does do that for individual readings. Okay? Put Bergen's use of the Peshitta to support the traditional text is on a reading-by-reading basis. Put another way, Bergen is not arguing, as are two streams advocates, that the Peshitta is representative of the King James tradition in every reading without qualification. To insinuate that Bergen was placing the Peshitta in the pure stream of transmission, as Ray does in his book, serves to mangle the witness of Bergen and hang conclusions upon him that he never made. You following that? Okay? Likewise, look, that's so important. You got to understand that. I went back and looked at the Revision Revised. I see where he's talking about the Peshitta, the way Bergen spelled it. I read what he said, and yes, he does use it, but it's on a case-by-case what? Basis. It's on a reading-by-reading basis. It's not this wave of the pen, and whoop, there's the Peshitta in the pure stream without any qualification or explanation. Okay? Likewise, with the writings of Edward Miller, another author mentioned by J.J. Ray on page 78 of God Only Wrote One Bible. Ray portrays Miller, an associate of Bergen, as being wholly on board with his assertion that the Peshitta was translated from the Greek Vulgate. A consideration of Miller's comments regarding the Peshitta reveals that Ray has overstated his case. Now, we don't have time to read all these. I just want to go to the middle one. Okay? There's a mistake in the first one anyway that we need to fix. I need to go back and fix it. The part that's in gray is wrong and needs to be changed. Okay, so let's just go to the second. This is what Miller said. Now remember, is Ray referencing Miller? Miller is one of the authorities that he is using to justify the placement of the Peshitta where he put it, right? And this is what Miller actually said. The Peshitta resembles the received text. Is there a big difference between saying that it resembles the received text and saying that the Peshitta was a translation of the received text? Okay. Ray says that the Peshitta was a translation of the received text and says, yep, Miller has testified, or what, something along those lines, right? But if you actually go to Miller, Miller says that it resembles the received text, not that it was an absolute translation of what? The received text. So we can look at the next one there too, I guess. In a similar manner, the Peshitta and Italic versions, including under the latter class, the best of the Old Latin versions, were made 200 years before those two manuscripts. He's referring to Aleph and B, okay? And supposedly, and especially the former, support the traditional text. Miller's not saying that the Peshitta and the Old Latin categorically support the traditional text in every what? In every case. Okay? So let's look at underneath that. In some cases, the extant Peshitta supports the traditional text, and in some cases it does not. As I just showed you, okay? I.e., the extant evidence is mixed. Miller's comment that the Peshitta resembles the received text is a more accurate representation of the facts on the ground when compared with the picture painted by Ray, Ruckman, Sorensen, and the two streams of Bible's advocates. Even a cursory evaluation of the extant textual data regarding the Peshitta reveals its tradition. This should say, there's a word missing here. Reveals its tradition is far from, should say, insert the word far, far from the specimen of purity that King James advocates would have us believe. As we observed in our investigation of the Gothic Bible in Lesson 87, when it comes to transmission, the situation is not as neat and tidy or clear-cut as the two streams of Bible's model indicates. Rather than being an objective emblem of textual purity, the extant Peshitta is viewed more accurately as a mixed text driving down the shoulder of transmission turnpike. Now, do you see why I came up with that illustration? Okay? So, as we saw last Sunday with the Gothic Bible, the Peshitta contains readings in its extant copies that King James advocates would never tolerate in a modern version. Yet, their charts and diagrams depict the Peshitta as being fundamentally the same as the King James Bible. This is an untenable double standard in pro-King James argumentation that needs to be jettisoned or revised to accord with the textual and historical facts. Okay? So, in the next lesson, that's next week, in the next lesson we will look at what happened when I publicly started asking questions regarding the two streams of Bible's paradigm of transmission. So everything that I have gone over so far with you about the Gothic and the Peshitta, this is all stuff that I looked at myself before I really told anyone what I was doing. Once I had seen some things for myself, I then went into some forums and some places and started asking some questions about this and found out that there are some others that have had similar misgivings, but for different reasons, okay, than the ones I've shared with you last Sunday and this Sunday. And that's what I want to talk about next week, and it's going to be about the Old Latin versus Latin Vulgate dichotomy that is on all of these charts of the streams of transmission. So, we have a few minutes for any short questions. Are you guys, look, I know this is all heavy stuff. I'm hoping that you're able to track with this and are seeing where all this is going and why we're doing this. Okay? Yeah.
So, going up to the middle quote on page 8 there, the shield to some of the received text. To read the second part of that, as Miller's quoting here, I'm assuming?
Yeah, it's Miller.
He says it did not include all the Catholic epistles. I don't call 3 John and Jude or Revelation Catholic epistles.
Well, that's just, he means church epistles. And he's just saying that there are some copies that are just missing that. So in other words, they're incomplete. The sections that had those are worn out. Then there are other copies that have that stuff in it.
Do you know what that man believed?
Who?
Miller. Do you know if he was a believer or was he a Catholic priest?
I think Miller, I have no reason to doubt Miller's, he's an Anglican. He's a friend of Bergen. He's a text critic of that generation who was trying to defend the traditional Greek against the Westcott and Hort Greek. I think when he means Catholic, he just means church epistles in a general sense. But I agree. When you read Catholic, they're like, whoa, you know, your anti-Catholic alarms go off or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's frankly a problem with this whole thing. Okay. The reason why the Vulgate is always on the badge line is because it's Catholic. It's associated in the minds of American fundamentalists as being Catholic. And you're not going to get any argument from me about the corruption of the Catholic Church. I understand all that, and I agree with all that, okay? But in the case of the Vulgate, you can't just hang corrupt on it without actually talking about what the readings in it are. If it has 1 John 5:7, if it has Mark 16, if it has the woman taken in adultery, then it's more pure than Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus, yet they have it in the same one, the same stream, and nobody ever talks about this. Okay? So there's issues here that this is a complex nut to try to crack here. And hopefully, you know, this is helping you to some degree. Did anybody else have a last minute? Yeah, Mike.
So the early editions of the Peshitta were not in line with the King James translation, right?
I'm sorry,
Early editions of the Peshitta were not in line with King James, but later editions were.
Well, I don't know the, ultimately, I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, that's what I get from...
Yeah, but remember the earliest one is from the 400s, nearly 350 years after.
But we don't really know what the source of the early editions was as far as the manuscript.
No one knows, and it would be speculation. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Any other questions? All right, we got to quit.